She's dead, too.
I know that, said Lila. But if they did see a woman in Lionhead, it means there are other women outside of dueling. Knowing we're not alone in this world, Janice, that would be huge.
Don't die,
the warden called after them as they rode up Ball's Hill. Lila said,
That's the plan.
And beside her, Tiffany Jones chimed in more conclusively,
We won't.
8. Tiffany had ridden all through her girlhood. Her family had run an apple orchard with a playground, goats to feed, a hot dog stand, and a pony ride.
I used to ride all the time, but there was some other stuff with the family, downsides, you could say. It wasn't all ponies. I started to run into some trouble and got out of the habit.
This trouble was no mystery to Lila, who had personally arrested Tiff more than once. That Tiffany Jones bore startlingly little resemblance to this one. The woman who rode astride the massive roan beside Lila's smaller white mare was a full-faced, auburn-haired woman in a white cowboy hat that would have suited any John Ford rancher. She had a self-possession about her that was utterly unlike the wretched drug addict Truman Mayweather had regularly tuned up on in the trailer next to his meth lab so long ago and so far away. And she was pregnant. Lila had heard Tiffany mention it at a meeting. That, Lila thought, was where at least part of her glow came from. It was dusk. They would have to stop soon. Maylock was visible, a spread of dim, dark buildings in a valley a couple of miles distant. The exploring party had been there and found no one, male or female. It seemed that only dueling held human life. Unless there really had been a woman in the men's prison, that was.
You seem like you're doing pretty well, said Lila carefully. Now?
Tiffany's laugh was amiable.
The afterlife clears your mind. I don't want dope, if that's what you mean.
Is that what you think this is? The afterlife?
Not really, said Tiffany,
and didn't pick the subject up again until they were lying in their sleeping bags in the shell of a gas station that had been abandoned in the other world, too.
Tiffany said, I mean, the afterlife, it's supposed to be heaven or hell, right?
They could see the horses through the plate glass, tied up to the old pumps. The moonlight gave their coats a sheen.
I'm not religious, Lila said.
Me neither, Tiffany said. Anyway, there's no angels and no devils, so go figure. But isn't this some kind of miracle?
Lila thought of Jessica and Roger Elway. Their baby, Platinum, was growing fast, crawling all over the place. Elaine Nutting's daughter, Nana, had fallen in love with Platt. An ugly nickname, but everyone used it. The kid would probably hate them for it later, and rolled her everywhere in a rusty baby carriage. Lila thought of Essie and Candy. She thought of her husband and her son and her whole life that was no longer her life.
Some kind, Lila said. I guess.
I'm sorry.
Miracle's the wrong word. I'm just saying we're doing all right, right? So it's not hell, right?
I'm clean. I feel good.
I got these wonderful horses, which I never in my wildest dreams imagined could happen.
Someone like me? Taking care of animals like these?
Never. Tiffany frowned.
I'm making this all about me, aren't I? I know you've lost a lot. I know most everybody here has lost a lot, and I'm just someone who didn't have nothing to lose.
I'm glad for you.
She was, too. Tiffany Jones had deserved something better. 9. They skirted Maylock and rode along the banks of the swollen Doors Hollow stream. In the woods, a pack of dogs gathered on a hummock to observe them as they passed. There were 6 or 7 of them. Shepherds and labs, tongues out, breath steaming. Lila took out her pistol. Beneath her, the white mare rolled its head and shifted its gait.
No, no, Tiffany said.
She reached a hand across and brushed the mare's ear. Her voice was soft but steady, not cooing.
Lila's not going to shoot that gun.
She's not.
Lila had an eye on the dog in the middle. The animal's fur was a bristly gray and black. It had mismatched eyes, blue and yellow, and its mouth seemed especially large. She wasn't a person who typically let her imagination run away from her, but she thought the dog looked rabid.
She certainly isn't. They want to chase us, but we're just doing our thing. We don't want to play chase. We're just getting along.
Tiffany's voice was airy and certain. Lila thought that if Tiffany didn't know what she was doing, she believed she knew what she was doing. They paced along through the underbrush. The dogs didn't follow.
You were right, Lila said later. Thanks.
Tiffany said she was welcome.
But it wasn't for you. No offense, but I'm not letting you put a fright in my horses, Chief.
10. They crossed the river and bypassed the high road the others had taken up the mountain, continuing instead on the lower ground. The horses descended into a dell that formed the gap between what was left of Lionhead on the left and another cliff face on the right, which rose up at a sharp, splintery slant. There was a pervasive metallic stench that tickled the backs of their throats. Crumbles of loose earth shook down, the embedded stones echoing far too loudly in the bowl created by the rises on either side. They tied up the horses a couple of hundred yards from the prison ruins and approached on foot.
A woman from somewhere else, Tiffany said. Wouldn't that be something?
Yes, Lila agreed. Finding some of our own still alive would be even better. Fragments of masonry, some as tall and wide as moving vans, were embedded higher up along the back of Lionhead, stabbed into the earth like enormous cenotaphs. As sturdy as they appeared, Lila could easily imagine them breaking loose under their own weight and tumbling down to join the pile at the bottom. The body of the prison had hit bottom and folded inward on itself, forming a vaguely pyramid-like shape. In a way, it was impressive how much of the building's body had survived the slide down the mountain, and hideous, too, in its decipherability, like a dollhouse smashed by a bully. Spears of jagged steel jutted out from the cement, and massive root-knotted clods of earth had settled on other parts of the debris. At the edges of this unplanned new structure were tattered breaches in the cement that offered glimpses of the black interior. Everywhere there were smashed trees, 20- and 30-footers snapped into raw shards. Lila put on a surgical mask that she'd brought.
Stay here, Tiffany. I want to come with you. I'm not afraid. Let me have one of them.
She stuck out her hand for a surgical mask.
I know you're not afraid. I just want someone able to go back if this place falls in on my head. And you're the horse girl. I'm just a middle-aged ex-cop. Also, we both know you're living for two.
At the nearest opening, Lila paused to wave. Tiffany didn't see it. She'd walked back to the horses. 11. Light filtered into the interior of the prison in sabers punched through the smashed concrete. Lila found herself walking atop a wall, stepping on the closed steel doors of cells. Everything was turned one quarter. The ceiling was on her right. What would have been the left wall was now the ceiling, and the floor was on her left. She had to lower her head to slip under an open cell door that hung down like a trap. She heard ticking noises, dripping noises. Her boots crunched against stone and glass. A clog composed of rock, shattered pipes, and chunks of insulation obstructed her forward progress. She flicked her flashlight around. A-level was stenciled in red paint on the wall above her head. Lila backtracked to where the door hung. She jumped and grabbed the doorframe, hoisting herself up into the cell. A hole had broken open in the wall on the opposite side of the hanging door. Lila made her way, carefully, to the breach. She crouched and ducked her way through. Serrations of broken concrete snagged at the back of her shirt, and the fabric tore. Clint's voice came to her, inquiring if maybe, just maybe, and don't take this as an accusation, please, there was a risk-reward ratio that needed to be reconsidered here.
Let's unpack it, shall we, Lila? The risk is that you are climbing into an unsettled wreck at the bottom of an unsettled mountain. Also, there are goddamn wild, deranged-looking dogs out there, and a pregnant drug addict waiting, or not waiting, with the horses.
And you are, again, no criticism, merely setting down the facts, darling. 45. Everyone knows that the prime age for a woman to crawl around unsettled and volatile ruins is from her late teens to her late 20s. You're out of the target group. It all adds up to a significant risk of death, horrible death, or unimaginably horrible death. In the next cell, Lila had to climb over a battered steel toilet, then slip down through another hole in the floor that had been the right wall. Her ankle bent funny when it hit the bottom, and she grabbed for purchase. Something metal slashed her hand. The wound on her palm was a deep red gash. It probably needed a stitch or two. She ought to turn back, get some ointment and a proper bandage from the first aid kit that they'd brought. Instead, Lila ripped off a piece of her shirt and wrapped her hand. She used the flashlight to find another stencil on the wall. Secure wing. This was good. That sounded like exactly the place where they'd seen the woman in the cell. What was bad was that the new hall was situated above her head, a shaft going upward. What was worse was the leg in one canted corner, raggedly severed 2 inches above the knee. It was clad in green corduroy. Nell Seeger had been wearing green cords when the expedition had left for Eagle. "I'm not going to tell Tiff about this," Lila said. Hearing herself speaking out loud both startled and comforted her. "It would do no good." Lila pointed her beam upward. The Lionhead's secure wing had become a great wide chimney. She shone the light from side to side, looking for a way to go, and thought she might see one. The ceiling of the wing had been of the drop panel type. The panels had all shaken loose in the slide, but the steel gridding remained in place. It resembled a trellis, or a ladder. "As for the reward," Clint offered, "you might find someone. Might. But be honest with yourself. You know that this wreck is empty, just like the rest of the world. There's nothing to be found but the bodies of the women who went with Nell. Let that one severed leg stand for all of them. If there were other women in the world you're calling our place, they would have made themselves known by now. They would at least have left some trace. What is it you think you have to prove? That women can be Marlboro men, too?" It seemed that even in her imagination, he couldn't just tell her he was afraid for her. He couldn't stop treating her like one of his incarcerated patients, throwing leading questions like dodgeballs in a playground game. "Go away, Clint," she said. And for a wonder, he did. Lila reached up and grabbed the lowest trellis of ceiling gridding. The crosspiece bowed but didn't break. Her head sang and she felt blood leaking around the edges of her rag bandage, but she hung on and pulled herself up and upright. She braced her boot on the crosspiece and pushed down. It bowed again, and held. Lila reached up, pulled, stepped. She began to ascend the ladder of gridding. Each time she came to the level of a cell door, Lila used her good left hand to hang on while she swung out into the air, shining the flashlight with her hurt right. There was no woman to be seen through the wired glass at the top of the first cell door, no woman in the second, no woman in the third. All she saw were bed frames sticking out from what had been the floors. Her hand pulsed. The blood was dripping down inside her sleeve. Nothing in the fourth cell, and she had to stop and rest, but not for too long, and definitely no looking down into the darkness. Was there a trick to this kind of effort? Something that Jared had mentioned about cross-country? Something to tell yourself? Oh, right, now she had it. "When my lungs start tightening up," Jared had said, "I just pretend there are girls checking me out, and I can't let them down." That wasn't much use. She'd just have to keep going. Lila climbed. The fifth cell contained just a cot, a sink, and a dangling toilet. Nothing more. She had arrived at a T. Off to the left, across the channel, the length of another hall stretched away. Far off, at the end of the hall, the beam of Lila's flashlight found what appeared to be a pile of laundry. A body or bodies, she thought. The remains of the other explorers. Was that Nell Seeger's puffy red jacket? Lila wasn't sure, but as cold as it was, she could smell the beginnings of decomp. They had been tossed around until they snapped, and then probably tossed around some more. There was nothing to do but leave them there. Something moved amid the pile, and she heard squeaking. The prison's rats had survived the tumult, it seemed. Lila climbed some more. Each metal grid seemed to give more under her weight, creaking longer and higher with every push-off. The sixth cell was empty, and so were the seventh and the eighth and the ninth. It's always the last place you check, isn't it? It's always on the top shelf of the closet at the very back. It's always the bottom file in the stack. It's always in the littlest, least used pocket of the knapsack. If she fell now, at least she'd die instantaneously. You always, 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 always fall from the topmost grid of the ceiling that you're using for a ladder in the hall of the maximum security prison that has gone sliding down the unstable remains of a former coal mountain. But she decided she was not going to quit now. She had killed Jessica Elway to defend herself. She had been the first female police chief in the history of Dueling County. She had clapped handcuffs on the Griner brothers, and when Lo Griner had told her to go fuck herself, she had laughed in his face. A few more feet wasn't going to stop her. And it didn't. She leaned out into the dark, swinging free as if unfurled by a dance partner, and cast the beam of her flashlight through the window of the 10th cell door. The blow-up doll had come to rest with its face against the glass. Its cherry-red lips were a bow of surprise made for fellatio. Its eyes were a thoughtless and seductive Betty Boop blue. A draft from somewhere caused it to nod its empty head and shrug its pink shoulders. A sticker on its head was printed with the label, "Happy 40th Birthday, Larry." 12. "Come on now, Lila," said Tiffany. Her voice drifted up from the well. "Just take one step and then worry about the next step." "Okay," Lila managed. She was glad that Tiffany hadn't listened to her. In fact, she didn't know if there were many things she'd ever been so glad about. Her throat was dry, her body felt too tight in her skin, her hand was burning. The voice below was another life, though. This dark ladder didn't have to be the end. "That's good. Now, one step," said Tiffany. "You just gotta go one step. That's how you start." 13. "A blow-up fuck-me doll," Tiffany marveled later. "Some a-hole's birthday present. They let him have shit like that?" Lila shrugged. "All I know is what I saw. There's probably a story, but we'll never know it." They rode all day and into the dark. Tiffany wanted one of the women in our place who'd had nursing experience to clean up Lila's hand pronto. Lila said she'd be okay, but Tiff was insistent. "I told that crone who used to be warden up at the prison we wouldn't die. We. That means both of us." She told Lila about the apartment she had in Charlottesville before meth addiction had napalmed the last decade or so. She'd kept a shitload of ferns. Buggers had flourished, too. "That's living right, when you got big houseplants," Tiffany said. Slumped low in her saddle, the pace of her horse rocking her so pleasantly, Lila had to fight to keep from falling asleep and possibly slipping off. "What?" "My ferns," said Tiffany. "I'm regaling you about my ferns to keep you from passing out on me." This made Lila feel giggly, but all that came out was a moan. Tiffany said not to be sad. "We can get you some. Ferns all over the fucking place. They ain't rare." Later, Lila asked Tiffany if she was hoping for a boy or a girl. "Just a healthy kid," said Tiffany. "Either way, so long as it's healthy."
"How about if it's a girl, you name her Fern?" Tiffany laughed.
"That's the spirit!"
Dueling appeared at dawn, the buildings floating through a blue haze. Smoke twisted up from the parking lot behind the remains of the squeaky wheel. Here, a communal fire pit had been set up. Electricity was still at a premium, so they cooked outside as much as possible. The squeak had proved an excellent source of fuel. its roof and walls were slowly being dismantled. Tiffany led them toward the fire. There were a dozen women there, shapeless in their heavy coats, caps, and mittens. Two big pots of coffee were boiling over the wide fire.
"Welcome home. We got coffee."
Coates stepped from the group.
"Unlike us, we got nothing," Lila said.
"Sorry. It was a fuck-me-Farrah doll in the secure wing. If there's anybody else in this world, there's still no sign of them. And the others..." She shook her head.
"Mrs. Norcross?"
They all turned to check out the new one, who'd arrived just a day earlier. Lila took a step toward her, then stopped.
"Mary Pack, is that you?"
Mary came to Lila and hugged her.
"I was just with Jared, Mrs. Norcross. I thought you'd want to know he's all right. Or he was, the last I saw him. That was in the attic of the demo house over in your neighborhood before I fell asleep."
Chapter 5 1 Tig Murphy was the officer that Clint told first. The truth about Evie and about what she'd said. That everything seemed to depend on whether or not Clint could keep her alive, but she would plead her case no more than Jesus had when hauled in front of Pontius Pilate. Clint finished by saying, "I lied because I couldn't bring myself to tell the truth. The truth is so big it's stuck in my throat."
"Uh-huh. You know I used to teach high school history, Doc?"
Tig was, in fact, looking at him in a way that reminded Clint intensely of high school. It was a gaze that doubted your hall pass. It was a gaze that wanted to see if your pupils were dilated.
"Yes, I know that," Clint said.
He'd pulled the officer into the laundry room where they could talk in private.
"I was the first person in my family to graduate from college. Busting chops in a women's prison wasn't exactly a step up for me. But, you know, I've seen how you care about these gals, and I know that even though a lot of them have done bad stuff, most aren't bad through and through. So I want to help."
The officer grimaced and rubbed a hand through the receding hair at his temples. You could see the teacher he'd been, picture him pacing around, going on about the vast difference between the legend of the Hatfields and the McCoys and the historical facts of the feud, dragging his fingers harder and harder through his hair the more excited and enthusiastic he got about the subject.
"So help," Clint said.
If not one of the officers agreed to stay, he would try to keep the prison locked down without them, and he would fail. Terry Coombs and the new guy had the remains of the police force. They could gather other men if necessary. Clint had seen the way Frank Geary had eyed the fences and the gates, looking for weak spots.
"You really believe this? You think she's magic?"
Tig said the word magic the way Jared said the word seriously, as in,
"You seriously want to see my homework?"
"I believe she's got some command of this thing that's happening, and more importantly, I believe that men outside this prison believe that."
"You believe she's magic?"
Tig gave him the suspicious teacher look again.
"Kid, just how stoned are you?"
"Actually, I do," Clint said, and raised a hand to stop Tig from speaking, at least for the moment. "But even if I'm wrong, we need to hold this prison. It's our obligation. We have to protect every one of our prisoners. I do not trust Terry Coombs in his cups, or Frank Geary, or anyone else to just talk to Eve Black. You've heard her. Whether she's just delusional or not, she's a genius at pissing people off. She will go on doing that until someone loses his shit and kills her. Someone or all of them. Burning at the stake isn't entirely out of the question."
"You don't believe that?"
"Actually, I do. Blowtorch brigades tell you anything?" Tig leaned against one of the industrial washers.
"All right."
Clint could have hugged him.
"Thank you."
"Well, it's my stupid job, you know, but okay, you're welcome. How long do you think we need to hold out?"
"Not long. A few days at most. That's what she says, anyway."
He realized that he was talking about Eve Black like an ancient Greek talking about an angry deity. It was outrageous, and yet it felt as true as anything. 2
"Wait, wait, wait," Rand
Quigley said after Clint had gone through everything a second time.
She's going to end the world if we let the cops have her? That was almost exactly what Clint believed, but he preferred to finesse it a bit.
We just can't let the local cops carry her off, Rand. That's the bottom line.
Rand's pale brown eyes blinked behind the thick lenses of his square-framed glasses, and his black unibrow sat on the crosspiece like a burly caterpillar.
What about the CDC? I thought you were talking to the CDC.
Tig handled this one head-on.
The CDC was bullshit. The doc made it up so we'd stay.
This is where we lose Rand, Clint thought. But Rand only glanced at Clint and then back to Tig.
Never got through to them?
No, Clint said.
Never at all?
Well, I got an answering machine a couple of times.
Fuck, Rand said. That blows.
You said it, buddy,
Tig said.
Can we still count on you if someone wants to start something?
Yeah, Rand said, sounding offended. Of course. They run the town, we run the prison. That's how it's supposed to be. Weddermore was next. The whole scenario amused him in a sour but genuine way.
It wouldn't surprise me in the slightest if Warrior Girl, the meth head slayer, was magic. I wouldn't be surprised if bunnies wearing pocket watches started hopping through the joint. What you're telling me is no nuttier than the Aurora. It doesn't change anything for me. I'm here for the duration.
It was Scott Hughes, at 19, the youngest of the bunch, who handed over his keys, his gun, his taser, and the rest of his gear. If the CDC wasn't coming to take Eve Black, he wasn't staying. He wasn't anybody's white knight. He was just an ordinary Christian who'd been baptized at the Lutheran church right there in Dueling and hardly missed a Sunday.
I like all you guys. You're not like Peters or some of the other dinks at this place, and I don't care that Billy's gay or that Rand's half-retarded. Those guys are okay.
Clint and Tig had followed him past intake to the front door of the prison and out into the yard to try and change his mind.
And Tig, you've always been cool. You seem fine too, Dr. Norcross, but I'm not dying here.
Who said anything about dying? Clint asked. The teenager arrived at his pickup, which stood on enormous Bigfoot tires.
Get real. Who do you know in this town who doesn't have a gun? Who do you know in this town who doesn't have two or three?
It was true. Even in Exurban, Appalachia, and Exurban might have been pushing it, they had a footlocker and a Shopwell in Dueling, but the nearest movie theater was in Eagle. Just about everyone had a gun.
And I mean, I've been to the police station, Dr. Norcross. They got a rack of M4s. Other stuff, too. The vigilantes show up after raiding the armory, no offense, but you and Tig can take those Mossbergs we got in the gun locker and shove them up your asses.
Tig was standing at Clint's shoulder.
So you're just gonna split?
Yeah, Hughes said. I'm just gonna split. Someone needs to open the gate for me.
Shit, Tig, Clint said, which was the signal. Tig sighed, apologized to Scott Hughes.
I feel terrible about this, man,
and zapped his colleague with his taser. This was a matter that they'd discussed. There were serious problems with letting Scott Hughes leave. They couldn't allow someone telling the town folks what a short roster they had, or outlining the limitations of the prison's armaments. Because Scott was right, the prison's armory was not impressive. A dozen Mossberg 590 shotguns, birdshot to load them, and each officer's personal sidearm, a .45-caliber pistol. The two men stood over their colleague, writhing on the parking lot pavement. Clint was queasily reminded of the Bertels' backyard, the Friday night fights, his foster sibling Jason lying bare-chested on the patio cement at Clint's filthy sneakers. Under Jason's eye, there had been a red, quarter-shaped mark from Clint's fist. Snot had leaked out of Jason's nose, and from the ground he had mumbled,
"It's okay, Clint."
The grown-ups all cheered and laughed from their lawn chairs, toasting with their cans of Falstaff. That time, Clint had won the milkshake. What had he won this time?
"Well, damn, now we done it," said Tig.
3 days ago, when they'd had to deal with Peters, Tig had looked like a man in the throes of an allergic reaction, about to pitch up a bellyful of spunky shellfish. Now he just looked like he had a touch of acid. He lowered himself to his knees, rolled Scott over, and zip-tied his wrists behind his back.
"How about we put him in B-Wing, Doc?"
"Okay, I guess."
Clint hadn't even considered where to put Scott. which did not exactly increase his confidence in his ability to deal with the developing situation. He squatted to grab Hughes's armpits and help Tig hoist him to his feet so they could bring him inside.
"Gentlemen," came a voice from just beyond the gate. It was a woman's voice, full of grit and exhaustion and delight. "Can you hold that pose? I want to get a good picture."
3. The two men looked up, their expressions the very essence of guilt. They could have been mafia button men about to bury a body. Michaela was even more delighted when she checked her first photo. The camera she carried in her purse was only a bottom-of-the-line Nikon, but the image was sharp. Perfect.
"Ahoy, ye scruffy pirates," Garth Flickinger cried. "What are ye about, pray tell?"
He had insisted on stopping at the nearby scenic lookout to sample the purple lightning, and he was feeling chipper. Mickey also seemed to have caught her second wind. Or maybe by now it was her fourth or fifth.
"Oh, shit, Doc," said Tig. "We are surely fucked."
Clint didn't reply. He stood, holding Scott Hughes and gaping at the newcomers standing in front of a battered Mercedes. It was as if a weird reverse landslide were going on inside his head, one where things came together instead of falling apart. Maybe this was how true inspiration came to a great scientist or philosopher. He hoped so. Clint dropped Scott, and the disoriented officer gave a moan of dissatisfaction.
"One more," Michaela called.
She snapped.
"And one more. Good. Great. Now, exactly what are you boys doing?"
"God's blood, it's mutiny,"
Garth cried, doing what might have been an imitation of Captain Jack Sparrow in Pirates of the Caribbean.
"They've rendered the first mate unconscious and soon will make him walk the plank. Arr!"
"Shut up," said Michaela. She grasped the gate, not electrified, fortunately for her, and shook it. "Does this have anything to do with the woman?"
"We are so fucked."
Tig said this as if he were impressed. "Open the gate," Clint said.
"What? Do it."
Tig started toward the entry booth, pausing once to look doubtfully back over his shoulder at Clint, who nodded and motioned him on. Clint walked to the gate, ignoring the steady click of the young woman's camera. Her eyes were red, which was to be expected after 4 days and 3 nights of wakefulness, but her companions were just as red. Clint suspected they might have been partaking of illegal stimulants. In the throes of his sudden inspiration, that was the least of his concerns.
"You're Janice's daughter," he said. "The reporter."
"That's right, Michaela Coates. Michaela Morgan, to the great viewing public. And I believe you're Dr. Clinton Norcross."
"We've met?" Clint didn't remember that.
"I interviewed you for the high school newspaper. Would have been 8 or 9 years ago."
"Did you like me?" he asked. Christ, he was old, and getting older by the minute. Michaela tipped a hand.
"I thought it was a little weird that you liked working in a prison so much. In a prison with my mom. But never mind that, what about the woman? Is her name Eve Black? Does she really sleep and then wake up? Because that's what I'm hearing."
"Eve Black is the name she goes by," Clint said. "And yes, she does indeed sleep and wake normally. Although not much else about her seems normal in the least."
He felt giddy, like a man walking a tightrope blindfolded.
"Would you like to interview her?"
"Are you kidding?" For the moment, Michaela appeared not the slightest bit sleepy. She looked feverish with excitement. The outer and inner gates began to trundle open. Garth hooked Michaela's arm with his own and stepped into the dead space between them, but Clint held up his hand.
"There are conditions."
"Name them," Michaela said briskly. "Although given the pictures I have in my camera, you might not want to be too greedy."
Clint asked, "Did you see any sheriff's cruisers nearby?"
Garth and Michaela shook their heads.
"No cruisers yet. No one watching the access road leading in from West Lavin." That was a trick Geary had missed, at least so far, and Clint wasn't terribly surprised.
With Terry Coombs seeking refuge in a flask, his number two, Mr. Animal Control Guy, had to be playing catch-up. But Clint didn't think he'd miss it for long. There might be someone on the way already.
In fact, and on second thought, he would have to assume that was the case, which meant going for pizza and eating with Jared was out. Geary might not care about anyone entering the prison, but he surely wouldn't want anyone leaving. The problematic head doctor, for one. Evie Black, possibly smuggled out in the back of a prison van, for another. "Your conditions?" Michaela asked. "It has to be quick," Clint said. "And if you hear what I think you're going to hear and see what I think you're going to see, you have to help me." "Help with what?" asked Tig, rejoining them. "Reinforcements," Clint said. "Weapons." He paused. "And my son. I want my son." 4. There was no pie at the Olympia. The woman who made the pies was sleeping in a cocoon in the break room. Gus Vereen, taking the deputy's orders, said he was shorthanded all around.
"Found some ice cream cake down at the bottom of the freezer, but I can't vouch for it. Been there since Hector was a pup."
"I'll try it," said Don, although it was a piss-poor substitute. A diner without pie was a disgrace, but with Frank Geary on the other side of the table, he was on his best behavior. Also present at the rear table of the diner were deputies Barrows, Wrangle, Eric Blass, plus an old legal beagle named Silver. They just finished eating a lousy lunch. Don had the halushki special, and it had arrived swimming in a pool of yellow grease. He'd eaten it anyway, partly out of spite, and Magic 8-Ball said that a case of the dribbling shits was in his future. The others had eaten sandwiches and burgers. None of them had finished more than half. They had also passed on dessert, which was probably smart of them. Frank had spent half an hour giving them all the rundown on what he knew about the situation at the prison.
"You think Norcross is boning her?" Don blurted at this point.
Frank turned a low-lidded gaze on him. "That's unlikely and irrelevant." Don received the message and hadn't said another word until Gus Vereen came around to see if they needed anything else. Once Gus left, Judge Silver spoke up.
"What do you see as our options, Frank? What's Terry's take on this?"
His Honor's skin tone was worryingly gray. His speech was wet, as if he were talking around a knot of chewing tobacco. "Our options are limited. We could wait Norcross out, but who knows how long that could mean. Prison's probably got quite a stock of food." "He's right," Don said. "There's no prime rib or nothing, but they got enough dry goods to last to the end of days." "The longer we wait," Frank went on, "the more talk gets around. A lot of guys around here might start thinking about taking things into their own hands." He waited for someone to say, "Isn't that what you're doing?" But no one did.
"If we don't wait?" the judge asked. "Norcross has got a son, and of course you know his wife."
"Good cop," the judge said. "Careful, thorough. The lady goes by the book."
Eric, busted twice by Chief Norcross for speeding, made a sour face.
"And we wish we had her," Geary said.
Don didn't believe that for a second. From the first, when Geary had jammed his hand under Don's armpit, treated him like a puppet, he'd seen that he wasn't the kind of fellow who accepted second position.
"But she's in the wind, and so is the sun. If they were around, I'd say we should try and get them to see if they couldn't convince Norcross to break loose from whatever thing he has going with the black woman."
Judge Silver clucked his tongue and stared into his coffee cup. He hadn't touched it. His tie had bright yellow lemons on it, and the contrast with his skin underlined the sickly look of the man. A moth fluttered around his head. The judge waved it away, and it flew off to alight on one of the light globes that hung from the diner's ceiling.
"So?" Judge Silver said.
"Yeah," Don said. "So what do we do?" Frank Geary shook his head and swept a few crumbs from the table, catching them in his palm.
"We put together a responsible group. 15-20 reliable men. We tool up. There should be enough body armor to go around at the station. God knows what else. We haven't exactly had time to take inventory."
"Do you really think—" Reed Barrows began doubtfully, but Frank overrode him.
"There's half a dozen assault rifles, anyway. They should go to the guys who can handle them. Everyone else carries either Winchesters or their sidearms or both.
Don here gives us the layout of the prison, any particulars that might help. Then we make a show of force and give Norcross one more chance to send her out. I think he will. The judge asked the obvious. If he doesn't? I don't think he could stop us. This seems rather extreme, even under the extraordinary circumstances, the judge said. What about Terry? Terry is... Frank brushed his crumbs onto the diner floor. He's drunk, Judge, Reed Barrows said, which kept Frank from having to say it. What he said, pulling a glum face, was, he's doing the best he can.
Drunk is drunk, Reed said.
Vern Rangel opined that this was a true statement. Then, the judge touched Frank's big shoulder, gave it a squeeze. Guess it's you, Frank. Gus Vereen came over with Don's slice of ice cream cake. The diner owner's expression was dubious. The slice was bearded in frost.
You sure, Don?
What the fuck?
Don said. If the pie ladies of the world were gone and he still wanted sweet stuff, he was going to have to eat more adventurously.
Frank,
Vern Rangel said.
What?
It sounded more like, what now?
I was just thinking maybe we ought to have a cruiser watching the prison, in case, you know, the doc decides to take her out and hide her somewhere.
Frank stared at him, then slapped the side of his own head, a good hard whack that made them all jump.
Jesus, you're right. I should have done that right away.
I'll go,
Don said, forgetting the ice cream cake. He got up fast, his thighs striking the underside of the table and making the cups and plates rattle. His eyes were bright.
Me and Eric. Anyone tries to get in or out, we'll stop them.
Frank didn't much care for Don, and Blass was just a kid, but maybe it would be okay. Hell, it was just a precaution. He didn't really think Norcross would try to take the woman out. To him, she probably seemed safer where she was, behind the prison walls.
Okay, he said. But if anyone does come out, just stop them. No drawn guns, you hear? No okay corral stuff. If they refuse to stop, just follow them and radio me ASAP.
Not Terry? The judge asked.
No, me.
Park at the foot of the prison access road where it meets West Lavin.
Got it?
Got it,
Don snapped. He was on the case.
Come on, partner, let's go.
As they left, the judge mumbled,
the unspeakable in pursuit of the uneatable.
What, Judge?
Vern Rangel asked. Silver shook his head. He looked weary.
Never mind. Gentlemen, I must say that on the whole, I don't care much for the way this is going. I wonder...
What, Oscar?
Frank asked.
What do you wonder?
But the judge didn't reply. 5.
How'd you know?
It was Angel.
About the baby.
The question drew Evie away from the Olympia Diner, where, from the eyes of the moth perched on the light globe, she'd been observing the men making their plans. And just to add to the fun, something else was going on, much closer. Clint had visitors. Soon she would have visitors as well. Evie sat up and inhaled Dueling Correctional. The stench of industrial cleaning products went horribly deep. She expected to die soon and felt sad about that, but she had died before. It was never nice, but it had never been the end, although this time might be different. On the bright side, she told herself, I won't have to smell this place anymore, this mixture of Lysol and despair. She'd thought Troy stank. The corpse piles, the fires, the fish guts thoughtfully left out for the gods. Gee fucking thanks, guys, just what we want. And the stupid Achaeans stomping around on the beach, refusing to wash, letting the blood cook to black in the sun and rust the joints of their armor. That was nothing compared to the inescapable reek of the modern world. She had been young and too easily impressed then, in the days before Lysol and bleach. Meanwhile, Angel had asked a perfectly fair question, and she sounded almost sane, for the time being, at least.
I know about your baby because I read minds. Not always, most of the time. I'm better at reading men's minds, they are simpler, but I'm pretty good with women, too.
Then you know, I didn't want to.
Yes, I know that. And I was too hard on you, before. I'm sorry, there was a lot going on.
Angel ignored the apology. She was focused on reciting something she'd clearly memorized, a little comfort she'd created to provide light when the dark was at its deepest, and there was no one awake with whom to speak and take her mind off herself and the things she had done.
I had to. Every man I killed did hurt me, or would hurt me if I give him a chance. I didn't want to put that baby girl down, but I couldn't let that be her life.
The sigh that Evie produced in response was thick with real tears. Angel was telling the truth, the whole truth, and nothing but the truth, of an existence in a time and a place where things had just not worked out. Of course, chances were slim that they would have worked out for Angel anyway. The woman was bad and mad. Even so, she was right. They had hurt her, and they probably would have hurt that baby girl, given time. Those men and all the men like them. The earth hated them, but it loved the fertilizer of their murderous bodies.
Why are you crying, Evie?
Because I feel it all, and it's painful. Now hush. If I may once more quote Henry IV, the game is afoot. I have things to do.
What things?
As if in answer, the door at the far end of A-Wing clashed open and footfalls approached. It was Dr. Norcross, officers Murphy and Quigley, and two strangers.
Where's they passes?
Angel shouted.
Those two don't have no passes to be back here.
Hush, I said, Evie told her, or I'll make you hush. We were having a moment, Angel. Don't spoil it. Clint stopped in front of Evie's cell. The woman pushed up beside him. There were purple pouches beneath her eyes, but the eyes themselves were bright and aware. Evie said, Hello, Michaela Coates, also known as Michaela Morgan. I'm Eve Black. She put her hand through the bars. Tig and Rand moved forward instinctively, but Clint extended his arms to hold them in place. Michaela clasped the offered hand with no hesitation. You've seen me on the news, I take it. Evie smiled warmly. I'm afraid I'm not big on the news. Too depressing. Then how do you know? Shall I call you Mickey, as your friend Dr. Flickinger does?
Garth jumped.
I'm sorry you didn't get to see your mother, Evie went on. She was a good warden.
Like fuck,
Angel muttered, and when Evie cleared her throat forbiddingly,
Okay, I'm hushing.
How do you know, Michaela began, that your mother was Warden Coates? That you took the name Morgan because some silly cockhound of a journalism professor told you that television audiences tend to remember alliterative names? Oh, Mickey, you never should have slept with him, but I think you know that now. At least the miscarriage saved you having to make a difficult choice. Evie clucked and shook her head, making her dark hair fly. Except for her red-rimmed eyes, Michaela was dead pale. When Garth put an arm around her shoulders, she clutched at his hand like a drowning woman clutching at a life preserver. How do you know that? Michaela whispered. Who are you? I am woman, hear me roar, Evie said, and once more laughed, a merry sound like shaken bells. She turned her attention to Garth. As for you, Dr. Flickinger, a word of friendly advice. You need to get off the dope, and very soon. You've had one warning from your cardiologist already. There won't be another. Keep on smoking those crystals, and your cataclysmic heart attack will come in... She closed her eyes like a carnival psychic, then popped them open. In about 8 months. 9, maybe. Most likely while watching porn with your pants around your ankles and a squeeze bottle of Lubriderm near at hand. Still shy of your 53rd birthday.
Worse ways,
Garth said, but his voice was faint,
Of course, that's if you're lucky. If you hang around Michaela and Clint here and try to defend poor defenseless me and the rest of the women here, you're likely to die a lot sooner.
You have the most symmetrical face I have ever seen.
Garth paused and cleared his throat.
Can you stop saying scary things now?
Apparently, Evie couldn't.
It's a shame that your daughter is hydrocephalic and must live her life in an institution, but that is no excuse for the damage you are inflicting on a formerly fine body and mind.
The officers were goggling at her. Clint had hoped for something that would prove Evie's otherworldliness, but this was beyond his wildest expectations. As if he had spoken this aloud, Evie looked at him and winked.
How do you know about Kathy? Garth asked. How can you?
Looking at Michaela, Evie said, I have agents among the creatures of the world. They tell me everything. They help me. It's like in Cinderella, but different. For one thing, I like them better as rats than as coachmen.
Evie, Miss Black, are you responsible for the sleeping women? And if so, is it possible you can wake them up again?
Clint, are you sure this is smart? Rand asked. Letting this lady have a jailhouse interview? I don't think Warden Coates would...
Jeanette Sorley chose this moment to stumble down the hall, holding up her brown top so it made a makeshift pouch.
Who wants peas? She cried. Who wants fresh peas?
Evie, meanwhile, seemed to have lost the thread. Her hands were gripping the prison bars hard enough to turn her knuckles white.
Evie,
asked Clint, are you okay?
Yes. And while I appreciate your need for haste, Clint, I'm multitasking this afternoon. You need to wait while I take care of something.
Then, to herself, rather than the half a dozen people outside her cell,
I'm sorry to do this, but he wouldn't have had long anyway.
A pause.
And he misses his cat.
6. Judge Silver had shuffled most of the way to the Olympia's parking lot before Frank caught up with him. Gems of drizzle shone on the slumped shoulders of the old fellow's topcoat. Silver turned at his approach, nothing wrong with his ears, it seemed, and gave him a sweet smile.
I want to thank you again for Coco, he said.
That's all right, he said. Just doing my job.
Yes, but you did it with real compassion. That made it easier for me.
I'm glad. Judge, it seemed to me that you had an idea in there. Would you like to share it with me? Judge Silver considered.
May I speak frankly?
The other man smiled.
Since my name is Frank, I'd expect nothing less.
Silver did not smile back.
All right. You're a fine man, and I'm glad you've stepped up to the plate since Deputy Coombs is, shall we say, hors de combat. And it's clear none of the other officers want the responsibility. But you have no background in law enforcement. And this is a delicate situation. Extremely delicate. Do you agree?
Yes, Frank said.
On all points. I'm worried about a blow-up. A posse that gets out of control and turns into a mob. I've seen that happen. Back during one of the uglier coal strikes in the 70s, and it was not a pretty thing. Buildings were burned, there was a dynamite explosion, men were killed.
You have an alternative?
I might. Get away, damn it.
The judge waved one arthritic hand at the moth fluttering around his head. It flew away and landed on a car aerial, slowly flexing its wings in the fine drizzle.
Those things are everywhere lately.
Uh-huh. Now what were you saying?
There's a man named Harry Rheingold in Coughlin. Ex-FBI, retired there 2 years ago. Fine man, fine record, several bureau commendations. I've seen them on the wall in his study. I'm thinking I might talk to him and see if he'll sign on.
As what? A deputy?
As an advisor, the judge said, and took a breath that rattled in his throat. And possibly as a negotiator.
A hostage negotiator, you mean?
Yes.
Frank's first impulse, childish but strong, was to tell the judge no way, he was in charge. Except, technically speaking, he wasn't. Terry Coombs was. And it was always possible Terry would show up, hungover but sober, and want to take the reins. Also, could he, Frank, stop the judge, short of physical restraint? He could not. Although Silver was too much of a gentleman to say it, unless he absolutely had to, of course, he was an officer of the court, and as such far outranked a self-appointed lawman whose specialties were catching stray dogs and doing ads for Adopt-a-Pet on the public access channel. There was one more consideration, and it was the most important of all. Hostage negotiation was actually not a bad idea. Dueling Correctional was like a fortified castle. Did it matter who pried the woman out as long as the job got done? As long as she could be questioned, coerced, if necessary, should they conclude that she actually might be able to stop the Aurora? Meanwhile, the judge was looking at him, shaggy eyebrows raised.
Do it, Frank said. I'll tell Terry. If this Rheingold agrees, we can have a skull session either here or at the station tonight.
So you won't?
The judge cleared his throat.
You won't take any immediate steps?
For this afternoon and tonight, I'll just keep a car posted near the prison.
Frank paused.
Beyond that, I can't promise. And even that depends on Norcross not trying anything funny.
I hardly think,
but I do.
Frank gravely tapped a finger against the hollow of his temple, as if to indicate thought processes hard at work.
Position I'm in right now, I have to. He thinks he's smart, and guys like that can be a problem. To others and to themselves.
Looking at it that way, your trip to Coughlin is a mission of mercy.
So drive carefully, Judge.
At my age, I always do. Judge Silver said.
His entry into the Land Rover was slow and painful to watch. Frank was on the verge of going to help him when Silver finally made it behind the wheel and slammed the door. The engine roared to life, Silver gunning it thoughtlessly, and then the lights came on, cutting cones through the drizzle.
Ex-FBI, and in Coughlin, Frank marveled. Wonders never ceased.
Maybe he could call the Bureau and get an emergency federal order enjoining Norcross to let the woman go. Unlikely, with the government in an uproar, but not out of the question. If Norcross defied them then, no one could blame them for forcing the issue. He went back inside to give the remaining deputies their orders. He'd already decided to send Barrows and Rheingold to relieve Peters and that blast kid. He and Pete Ordway could start making a list of guys, responsible ones, who might form a posse, should a posse be needed. No need to go back to the station, where Terry might show up. They could do it right here at the diner.
7.
Judge Oscar Silver rarely drove anymore, and when he did, he no longer exceeded 40 miles an hour, no matter how many cars stacked up behind him. If they began to honk and tailgate, he found a place to pull over and let them go by, then resumed his stately pace. He was aware that both his reflexes and his vision had declined. In addition, he had suffered 3 heart attacks and knew that the bypass operation performed on his failing pump at St. Teresa's 2 years ago would only hold the final infarction at bay for so long. He was at peace with that, but he had no wish to die behind the wheel, where a final swerve might take one or more innocent people with him. At only 40, less within the city limits, he thought he would have a fair chance to apply braking and shift into park before the lights went out for good. Today was different, however. Once he was beyond Ball's Ferry and on the old Coughlin Road, he increased his speed until the needle hovered at 65, territory it hadn't explored in 5 years or more. He had reached Rheingold on his cell, and Rheingold was willing to talk, although the judge, a crafty old soul, hadn't wanted to discuss the subject of their confab on the phone. Probably a needless precaution, but discretion had ever been his byword, and that was good news. The bad news, Silver suddenly found that he did not trust Frank Geary, who talked so easily about gathering a bunch of men and storming the prison. He had sounded reasonable enough back at the Olympia, but the situation was utterly unreasonable. The judge didn't care for how practical Frank made such a move sound, when it ought to be an absolute last resort. The windshield wipers clicked